Mountain story is perhaps the most misunderstood parable of all time. I'll explain the picture in a moment. I wanted to start with Mothering Sunday. The first Mothering Sunday in our household, when Abby arrived on the scene, our first child, came when she was just a few months old. And Kirsten had reminded me several times that week that Mothering Sunday was coming. I was very grateful for the reminder, and duly popped a card in the post to my mother. I completely missed the hint that I was supposed to do something on behalf of Abby for her mother. Big mistake. So I now have a checklist. What I need to do on Mothering Sunday to show the mothers of my life that they are loved. Card in the post to my mum, check. Phone my mum, check. Make sure the children have made a card for their mum, check. Buy some chocolate, check. Possibly push the boat out and buy some Baileys, check. That ought to do it. My mum and Kirsten will surely know that they are loved each Mothering Sunday if we complete that checklist. So showing our love, showing our devotion, doesn't seem to be that hard, does it? Now Jesus meets a man who is after a similar kind of checklist for showing his devotion to God. And the exchange that takes place between Jesus and this man, in that exchange, Jesus tells a story that has become one of the best known stories in the Bible, and also the most misunderstood. It makes for a great school assembly. The Good Samaritan story works as a really good pep talk to be socially responsible and stir ourselves up to love others. But that is so wrong. For just four verses earlier, Jesus says to his Father in heaven, "You have hidden these things from the wise and the learned and revealed them to little children." Now, if we can humble ourselves this morning as little children, we may discover Jesus revealing through this story how hard it is to love, revealing an unlikely rescuer and revealing an inexhaustible power. How hard it is to love an unlikely rescuer and an inexhaustible power. So let's start with how hard it is to love. At the start of the story, verse 25, we read, "On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus." So it's this guy who's got the tick list, and he wants to run it past Jesus. Some translators say that he's an expert in the law. Some say a lawyer, and some say a religious expert. Now, he's not a lawyer in the modern sense. He's not going to pick up a job at your local solicitor's firm in Trowbridge. He's an expert in the law of Moses. That's the first five books of the Old Testament, which includes the Ten Commandments. And notice how he asks his question to test Jesus. This is not a man who's soul-searching. Jesus claims to be the mind of God. And this religious expert wants to expose him as a fraud. He knows Jesus says the way to God is through him. So how can he make Jesus contradict the law of Moses? "Teacher," he asks. Sounds respectable, but we know it's hollow. "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" In other words, what must I do to keep peace with God and secure my place in God's family? Well, the question assumes that I can attain eternal life through doing things that will please God. And Jesus is careful not to contradict the law of Moses, but does expose how flawed it is to try to fulfill the demands of the law by ourselves. And Jesus replies with a question. Verse 26. "What is written in the law?" he replied. "How do you read it?" The lawyer answers by quoting Leviticus and Deuteronomy in verse 27. He says, love the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus replied. Jesus saying, I agree. We've no argument here. Do this and you will live. But no one has ever done it. No one other than Jesus, that is. But it will take a while for the penny to drop for this religious expert. So not wanting to quit there, the lawyer presses for more. Perhaps he assumes he's got the love God with all your heart and strength and soul and mind bit nailed down, because he passes over this bit. Presumably he thinks that his devotion to God is expressed through his religious duties, his religious doings and busyness, and all of that will already please God. And so in verse 29 he asks, and who is my neighbour? And that's a reasonable question. When the Old Testament had been written, life was simpler. An Israelite's neighbour would have been his fellow Israelite, and perhaps a few other foreign residents. But now, life is more complex in Jerusalem. There's a foreign state in power. Roman soldiers line the streets. There are foreigners and pagans, that's non-Jews, all over the place. So the lawyer thinks, let's narrow this down. Are we talking about the person who lives next door? In which case, sure, I'll lend them a bowl of sugar when they need it. I can even be a shoulder to cry on, or give them a bit of cash when they're short. Or are we talking about every God-fearing Jew, perhaps in a 3-mile radius? I'm sure I could be neighbourly to any of them. In reply, Jesus said, verse 30, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. Now, Jerusalem is high up. Jerusalem is 3,300 feet above Jericho. And it was an 18-mile descent from Jerusalem to Jericho. When we were driving here this morning and found ourselves going the wrong way and hitting sign upon sign that said you can't go this way, we did end up on a road that was quite long and straight and a good descent. And Emily said, that would be a good road to cycle down, as long as we didn't have to cycle up going home. Now, this road was forged by water that originally made its way from Jerusalem to Jericho, called wadis. I don't know if you can see them. Can you see a bit of a track through there? Lots of twists and turns. This would have been brilliant if you had a mountain bike. 18 miles of descent from Jerusalem to Jericho. Brilliant twists and turns for mountain bikers, but unfortunately also brilliant for muggers. Because it's so twisty and turny, you can't see who might be waiting around the next corner for you, but they can see you coming a long way off. In this story, the man who is making the journey, we discover, was stripped of his clothes. He was beaten, and the muggers went away, leaving him half dead. The next part of the story is there to raise our hopes. Along comes a priest. Surely he'll help the man. But in verse 31, we read, when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. Along comes a Levite. That's like the temple worship leader. Surely this time. But verse 32 says, when he came to the place and saw him, he too passed by on the other side. Presumably, both these men feared stopping in a dangerous place. Then comes a Samaritan. Now, given Jesus is talking to a Jewish audience, we'd probably expect a bit of booing at this point. Samaritans were not loved. The expectations of what this man would do would be very, very low. If the priest and the Levite had walked past, there's not much hope when a Samaritan comes by. There was a lot of enmity between Jews and Samaritans. Samaritans were half Jew and half Gentile. They had a different view of God in the scriptures. They'd become enemies. Surely this low life is of no use. But in verse 33, Jesus says, when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Oil to soothe, wine to disinfect. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii. That's about 2 days' wages. And he gave that money to the innkeeper, saying, look after him. And when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. So he's left the tab open, and he's prepared to pay whatever it takes. So the lawyer's cogs may be turning frantically at this moment. You mean I should be prepared to sacrificially love all people, even those I look down my nose at? Seriously disagree over theology with? Love people with all my resources, even when it's dangerous and risky and costly, all the time? How hard is it to love like this? To love God with our whole selves, all of the time. To love others without bias, as we would take care of ourselves all of the time. I haven't got that nailed down. Has the lawyer? Have you? I find this so challenging. Like the religious expert, I often reassure myself that my devotion to God by pouring time into church and reading my Bible and trying to serve others and love others will do it. But where is the focus of my heart, that my heart's desire most often? What am I most devoted to most of the time? My heart, my mind, my strength is often consumed with things that put God in at least second place. I find it impossible to remain wholly devoted to him all of the time. I find it easy to set up a direct debit to sponsor a child in Africa and feel like I've done my bit. But largely, the plight of others is out of sight, out of mind. I find it impossible to remain wholly compassionate and lovingly sacrificial to people often, let alone most of the time, let alone all of the time. If the law of Moses is going to judge me for my devotion to God and my sacrificial neighbourliness to others, I'm in serious trouble. My selfishness consumes me. This sin is defeating me. I'm already half dead, lying on the roadside, gasping for life. I can't do this. I'm done for. How hard is it to love? But then Jesus reveals an unlikely rescuer. There's far more to it in the story than just this. We miss so much if we read a parable in isolation. The rest of the Bible sheds much more light on its meaning. A few verses earlier, at the end of chapter 9, we're told that Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. Or in the ESV, he set his face for Jerusalem. Having become man and yet remained fully God, Jesus fixes his eyes on Jerusalem, where he knew his earthly ministry would complete. Everything he now did and said was in the immediate shadow of the cross. Who'd have thought that God would leave his throne room and enter the neighbourhood of those who positioned themselves as his enemies? Who'd have thought that the creator of everything would notice us on the roadside, defeated by sin, unable to be rescued by religion, philosophy, science, the pursuit of pleasure or escapism, or any person other than Jesus? Who'd have thought that this King of Kings would get alongside us, put himself in the way of danger, offer us his blood like wine to disinfect us from selfishness and all other sin? Who'd have thought that this man upon the cross, this most unlikely of rescuers, would open up heaven's treasures for us, God's mercy, God's forgiveness and healing, poured out to a world so abandoned, so broken, so helpless? It's too hard to love, as God's law demands us to love. The law exposes me for what I really am and condemns me to death. Jesus is the one who has mercy. Jesus is our unlikely rescuer. I suppose that's why this parable is so often misunderstood. We assume that the story's hero is the Samaritan, and that we're to be the hero, we're to be the Samaritan. With a good pep talk, we can be like that. But if we miss the point, we miss the fact that it's Jesus who's like that, and Jesus came like that for us. And as he forgives us, he doesn't just finish there. He also gives us an inexhaustible power. Such love changes us. We know that the Lord demands us to love God with everything we've got and to love our neighbours as ourselves. We can't achieve this by working through a tick list of tasks. It's not about what we do, but about the kind of people we become. When we meet Jesus, when we say sorry for all our selfishness and other sin, when we transfer our trust from other things to him as our only source of rescue, when we accept his friendship and his lordship, something amazing happens in us. The Apostle Paul put it like this in Galatians 2:20. He said, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Christ lives in us. He lives in us. His spirit is an inexhaustible power to love. His spirit enables us to see, to have compassion, to get alongside, to act generously and sacrificially. When we falter, we come back to him, and he forgives and refills us, and we go again. And then we falter, and we come back to him, and he forgives and he refills us, and we go again. And there are so many ways in which we can be Jesus-like neighbours in our global community. There are so many in our nation who are spiritually poor and broken. There are so many who are heartbroken in mental anguish or hostage to addiction. There are so many who are cold and hungry. There are so many who are persecuted. Only the wine that Jesus offers will solve the heart of each problem. But we can be transformed into his mouthpiece, into his hands, into his feet. And so this morning, why don't we pause for just a moment and reflect? Perhaps close our eyes and think, who is God asking you to notice this morning? What would soothing oil look like in that situation? How risky or costly might that be to you? Let's not misunderstand this parable. It's far more than a pep talk to be socially responsible and loving. Let's be reminded today that it's simply too hard to show love as God's law demands us to love. The law exposes us for what we really are and condemns us to death. Jesus is our unlikely rescuer. And if we receive King Jesus, he gives us his inexhaustible